When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When they actually said you've got a large cranial mass, we think it's a brain tumour, one of my reactions was, oh, that's good. It's not dementia, it's not a stroke. At least I can kind of deal with it. And it's quite a weird emotion to have when you're faced with that for the first time. I think if you have humour, and it's pretty dark humour, to be fair, given what you're dealing with, it just helps to de-stress it and make what you're dealing with less demonised, if that's the right word, and less scary. This applies probably to anyone who's been through brain trauma. Is to not beat yourself up that you can't get back to where you were. Accept that, almost grieve Andy Mark 1 and kind of celebrate Andy Mark 2 and go, right, this is who I am. This is what I can do. Let's make the most of that now. How can I best use that?
Hello and welcome to On A Good Day with me, Elizabeth Callahan.
And me, Julia Ajayi. This is the podcast which delves into brain injury and its impact on all involved. We're partners of Brain Injury Survivors, helping others navigate this life-changing journey.
On today's show, we're talking to Andy Tudor, who was diagnosed with a large 7-centimetre brain tumour back in 2017. Just weeks later, he underwent life-saving neurosurgery.
He has since gone on to have an active role in raising awareness of brain tumour through volunteering and as the co-host of Let's Talk About Brain Tumours, a podcast run by the Brain Tumour Charity.
In this episode, Andy talks about how his family and humour have got him through some dark days. He also reveals some of his strategies for dealing with fatigue, which include a can of baked beans. All will be revealed. Andy, a huge welcome to the show.
Hello.
We were actually on your podcast around a year ago now. So it's great to have you here with us for On A Good Day and during Brain Tumour Awareness Month as well.
Glad to be here.
So Andy, let's start off with a bit of background, your story and how you discovered you had a brain tumour.
Thanks for having me on, by the way. About 7 years ago now, 2017, I'd had a few symptoms which, looking back, probably if you piece of the jigsaw together, would have sort of been symptomatic of a brain tumour. But at the time, when I was 52, I just thought I was getting older. Didn't know what these things like headaches, a bad back, limping, forgetfulness, tiredness. Then I was rushed to hospital with severe symptoms. When I woke up one morning and I couldn't move my left arm and leg very well and I couldn't speak. Blue lighted down to hospital, and that's where they diagnosed the fact that I had a brain tumour. So in the medical terms, it was a large cranial mass. No idea what that is, and they said it's likely to be a brain tumour. So my first reaction was, how long have I got? Because I knew nothing about brain tumours at the time. And then once they'd sort of settled me down a bit and I got talking to a Macmillan nurse and then looking at the charities, websites and information, I realised that actually what I had likely had wasn't necessarily going to, kill me straight away, and that I would have a chance of a reasonably long life after that. So like you said, about 6 weeks afterwards, so February the 16th, 2017, emblazoned on my mind, I had my brain surgery, 6 hours or so. In fact, the most thing I was proud about at the time was that I remembered Valentine's Day 2 days before that, which was, I thought, yes, because I've been married for many years to my ever so loving wife and family. And I had a reasonably successful surgery, took about 6 hours, as I said, on the Thursday, home on the Saturday, would you believe, and then recuperated, recovered. It took about 4 months to get back to work part time, about 8 months full time. Then after a couple of years, it was just too much. So I had to sort of give up work, unfortunately. So all was fine. And then 2 years ago, I had some regrowth. So after you've had a brain tumour, you have annual scans just to check. And the fourth one of those picked up sorry, the fifth one of those picked up that I had a regrowth. So round about this, on the edge of where the previous one was, they think it was some cells that may have laid dormant, and they don't know what started it off again. But this one was about the size of a grape. So in my world, quite small, because my original one had been 7 centimetres, which my daughter always said she knew I only had half a brain, and that proved it. But the regrowth was small and relatively treatable by, the Poshton word is stereotactic radiotherapy, or gamma knife, where they basically zap it with radiation. And that seems to have worked. So I had the all clear from that, from my second scan literally a couple of weeks ago. So I'm back to being all clear again, thankfully, and hopefully should have a reasonably full long lifetime from now on. So I'm still dealing with the consequences of the brain surgery and the brain tumour itself, with extra fatigue. I have balance issues, so I can't drive anymore because my spatial awareness isn't what it should be. Tinnitus, and just my memory isn't as sticky as it used to be. If I was doing a quiz on the telly, I'd be brilliant if it was delayed a minute, because I can get the answers out, but it takes a while to get it out. So,
Andy, so can I just say, congratulations on getting the all clear. That must have been a really big moment for you, and clearly must have been pretty frightening when they found that. I mean, the whole thing at the beginning must have been pretty frightening, but did it feel like, oh my goodness, it's happened again? Like, how did you approach it kind of the second time round?
Yes, it's a good question. It was almost, I wouldn't say worse. It was, when I was first diagnosed, it was from flash to bang of the shock of being diagnosed and the harshness of the symptoms to the surgery was all a bit of a whirlwind. There was no choice. That was like, right, you're on a roller coaster, you can't get off. And it all happened, and I thought, okay, that's fine. I've got over that. What could happen that's possibly worse than having a brain tumor? And I was making a good recovery. But then when the regrowth was detected, it was like someone knocking all the wind out of your sails, because it was like I was just about ready to celebrate 5 years, because the sad statistic in the UK is that only 12% of brain tumor people diagnosed with a brain tumor survive 5 years. So that's about 1 in 8. And that covers all ages. Yeah, it covers all ages and all types of brain tumours, to be fair. And mine wasn't one of the nastier ones. But I was just about to celebrate 5 years. I'm a 1 in 8. And then you get the regrowth. And it's like, oh. But after the initial shock again, thankfully, with radiotherapy, it's so much easier. So after the radiotherapy, I was you literally have, it's great because you have the treatment in your own clothes. So it doesn't feel like you're in hospital. So that's always a good thing. And I went home the day of the actual radiotherapy. And after about 10 days, I felt back to normal. So no real symptoms or side effects other than some of my hair fell out. So it was a bit of a wake-up call. I have to admit, since then, it's proving harder, perhaps, to get excited about things. Because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, it's come back once, it might come back again. On the flip side, the neurosurgeon has said, well, if this happens every 2 or 3 years and you get some regrowth, you can treat it with radiotherapy and it shouldn't affect the longevity of your life. So it's yin and yang in a way. It's tough living with that thought all the time that there could well be something else growing inside your head that basically wants to kill you. On the other hand, I've got to be so careful because I feel blessed or lucky that I'm one of the 1 in 8 that's got to 5 years, let alone 7 years. So
Andy, that's it's a really scary statistic, isn't it? And
it is, yeah.
You know, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, that's something that you've probably been shouting about a little bit more.
Yeah, the two, that's one of the statistics. The other statistic, which is, I don't think people realise, is that brain cancer is the biggest cancer killer of children and anyone under 40. So it's like, really? Yes, it is. So we hear all, you know, not every day, but we hear a lot about sort of breast cancer, prostate cancer, and lung cancer, maybe less. But hardly anyone seems to talk about brain tumor or brain cancers. The research funding it gets is very low, about 3% of what the UK spends on research. I don't want to turn this into a political thing, but it's just phenomenal. The treatments for brain tumors haven't really changed in the last 20 years or so. So survival rates aren't getting better as they are with other sort of common cancers. and yet it's the biggest killer of children and people under 40 in terms of cancer. So it's scary, to be honest. So that's why I feel lucky that I'm here. I also feel it's kind of my duty in a way to try and raise awareness and try and two things really. One is try and make that statistic change so that the survival rates for brain tumors and the way they're treated is improved. And wow, what a legacy that would be. And also, not that I'm planning on leaving a legacy very soon, by the way, but that will be a legacy. And also to raise awareness so that people like me, probably the majority of the population, haven't got a clue what a brain tumor is. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't do. And they haven't got, they won't have a clue of what the symptoms are. So if I can just help raise awareness a little bit so that if people have two or three symptoms that are persistent, they might go, I might have something that I should check with an MRI or a CT scan when otherwise they may not. So if I can do those two things, and part, you know, this podcast is part of that, then wow, what an achievement that would be.
And what a legacy, Andy. And I'm sure that, as with many other things, early diagnosis will help.
Absolutely, yeah. It's I don't know the bull statistics, but I think we're the same with other cancers. The longer you leave it, the outcomes, not just survival, but the quality of life as well. And especially with the brain, it's such a complex organ that anything growing in there, the longer it's in there, even if it's removed completely, the longer it's in there, the worse the effect is. And it can affect so many different areas of your personality, your bodily functions, for want of a better phrase, you know, how you interact, how you walk, how you talk, how you are as a person. That, yeah, the sooner it's discovered. So for me, for example, being extreme, I'm a walking example that because my first brain tumor wasn't discovered until it was pretty much killing me, it resulted in major brain surgery in about 7-8 months before I got back to work. Because the regrowth was discovered early, I could have radiotherapy, and I was pretty much back to normal in about 10 days. So that I'm literally a walking example of the benefits of early diagnosis, because it's life threatening and months off work compared to a routine operation, pretty much, and in your own clothes, and you know, 10 days later you're feeling as back to as you were with no symptoms. So it's the difference is amazing.
But Andy, you only knew about the regrowth presumably because you were getting scanned.
Yes. Yes.
So you had no symptoms?
No, I didn't know anything about it. That's why it came as a bolt out of the blue.
What symptoms did you have initially, and what are the key symptoms that people can look out for as warning signs?
Yeah, I don't want to scare people, by the way, because lots of people, most of us have these in isolation, but the main ones are really bad and persistent headaches. Now, everyone gets headaches. So if you get a headache, don't think, oh, I've got a brain tumor. It's just persistent headaches that are maybe more, painful than normal. So that's a key sign. Sometimes people get vision problems, so slightly blurred vision. Quite often brain tumours can be the initial sort of discovery can be at the opticians, because it can affect your eyesight if it's anywhere near that. Other things are loss of memory. So if you start becoming very absent-minded, and again, as we get older, that can happen. But it's things like when I drove home one day, I parked up and I looked up and I was outside the wrong house. It was close to where I live, but I'd driven to the wrong house. If it gets to the point where you're having, where you're nauseous, so you're feeling sick a lot and being sick a lot, that is another symptom as well. And then quite often things like balance issues. So if you get up and you fall over a bit, or if you have, I had a limp. So that's how, one of the reasons why mine was noticed, because someone, I was at work, walking down the corridor at work, and someone said, oh, why are you limping? I wasn't aware I was. So it's those, if you have, I think those are the main ones. So if you have two or three of those symptoms persistently, that's when you should start thinking, well, it's more than a cold. It's more than a, you know, feeling a little bit off key or off colour, call it what you will. It's worth going to talk to the doctor about having an MRI. So with younger children, it's harder because they can't necessarily tell you what's happening. So with younger children and babies, it's more the eye problems and nausea. And if they complain about headaches a lot, those are the things that, if it's persistent and happens a lot, those are things to sort of look out for.
How long were you having symptoms for, would you say?
Looking back, probably about 18 months.
Ooh,
So
ooh,
it
ooh.
was because the headaches were starting, but again, I was 52, so I was thinking, oh, is that what happens when you get old, when you have to concentrate more at work? I went to the doctor and they said, did you play rugby at school? Yeah, I did. I was a hooker, in which is in the front row of the scrum. Oh, he said, you probably got some early arthritis in your neck. Okay, all right, fine. And then when I went in, because I was starting to almost like have a dropped foot when I was walking and limping, and they did a, like a push pull test and tested the muscular side of things, and everything was fine. So yeah, off you go. So in isolation, these things could be dismissed, but as a whole, I reckon it was about 18 months. And then they were getting progressively worse, if that makes sense. So it's a weird, this is going to sound quite strange, but because of the driving in, pulling up to the wrong house, and dare I say, occasionally I went down a one-way street one time and met a bus coming the other way, which was a little bit embarrassing. Because of those things, I'm thinking, oh, I might be getting dementia. And then on the morning, especially when I woke up and I couldn't move my left arm and leg very well, and I couldn't speak, I'm thinking stroke. Because when I went into the hospital, they first put me into the stroke unit and they kept telling me, can you move your face? All this kind of stuff. So when they actually said, you've got a large cranial mass, we think it's a brain tumor, one of my reactions was, oh, that's good. It's not dementia, it's not a stroke. At least I can kind of deal with it. And it's quite a weird emotion to have when you're faced with that for the first time.
Well, I guess you had a solution in a way because you could have that surgery to remove it, even though that must
Yeah,
be very scary.
definitely. I've thought about it a lot since, and it's something I've quoted once or twice, is to my mind, to get through any trauma, be it brain tumor or cancer treatment, you need four things. One is hope that you can get through it, or at least extend the quality of life. One is a plan, so you know how to deal with it. The third one is love from your family and friends, and the fourth one is luck. Because we all need a bit of luck, you know, especially the brain tumor. If it's in the wrong place, or it's grown where it shouldn't do, or it's wrapped around your optic nerve, or whatever, then it's going to make life a lot harder. So, with those four things, if you get all of those falling okay, then you can make a reasonably good recovery and have good quality of life afterwards. So, the plan and the hope at the initial front is really, really important to give you that impetus almost to go, no, I can actually get through this and come out the other side, and it isn't all overwhelming and scary. And that applies as much to the family, very much so, as to the patient. Because I think I kind of had it easy when I was first treated. My daughter said, because I was talking about, you know, going into surgery, and they'd said you might not come out. And my daughter said, she was 17 at the time. She goes, well, you got it easy, Dad. I said, why is that? She said, well, you'll be asleep. You've got the best seat in the house. I said, if you don't wake up, we won't know about it. We're the ones that are going to have to deal with it. And I thought, yeah, she's got a point. So it's having that hope and that plan is equally, if not more, important to the family as it is to yourself.
And also, Andy, I think that we can hear from your approach to your experiences that actually you held on to that hope and took a very solutions-based approach to your awful diagnosis by the sound of it. I think it's probably true to say that Elizabeth and I can both relate to what your daughter said. So I think that was very insightful from her. But I love those four things: hope, a plan, love, and luck. How wonderful.
And a
Yeah,
bit of
that's.
humor as well. I think, Andy, I think you've definitely applied that as well.
Oh, humor is massive. So again, it's not always my daughter that's funny, but she kept me grounded in a way, so that, because she was there initially with me when I was going through the treatment, you know, between diagnosis and surgery. And it was a pretty difficult time. And she'd come down in the morning. She said, how are you feeling, Dad? How are you? And if I said, oh, I'm feeling a bit tired today, a bit rough, she said, well, it's not all about you, Dad. And that would be it then. And we just carry on having a normal conversation. And that really helped in a way to sort of, I think if you have humor, and it's pretty dark humor, to be fair, given what you're dealing with, then it just helps to de-stress it and make what you're dealing with less demonized, if that's the right word, and less scary, because you kind of joke about it. So we had quite a healthy sense of humor that others might think a little bit inappropriate, should we say, but you know, it just it helped us, and it as a family helped us get through.
You said about love being one of those four pillars that you found important.
Yeah.
How was that support from your family? We've heard about your daughter's wonderful sense of humour, and she obviously helped keep you going, and I'm sure the rest of the family too. But how did you all pull together on that, and what really helped you in terms of practical assistance after some of those effects on the wider family?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a complex thing. I mean, I am very lucky that I've got a very patient, supportive, loving wife in particular. We got married in 88. If I could do the maths, I'd tell you. So we're coming up to however many years that is, 36, I think, this year. I'll make sure I remember, by the way, by the time we get to our wedding anniversary. I'm blessed to have had a loving, caring relationship with Jane. And she was the rock, really, that helped me through this. I'm going to get emotional. One example was fairly soon after diagnosis, and I was in hospital, they kept me in for 3 or 4 days. I asked Jane to bring in some writing paper and some envelopes because I felt like I wanted to write the kids a letter in case I didn't make it through. I mean, they're all teenagers. So Ellen was 17, the other two were at uni. So they're not, they weren't tiny kids, but I just felt like, and Jane said, no, I'm not doing that. You're going to get through this. And that, looking back, that was so valuable that she wasn't giving up. So if Jane's not giving up, then I shouldn't give up. That was one example where the love just really, really helped. And then just so Jane also gave up work so she could effectively care for me. I'd like to think I didn't need caring for, but now I'm a bloke, so what do I know? So yes, she gave up work, and so in terms of, you know, I'm just driving everywhere, but making sure I ate on time because I need to eat on time. It's understanding between us, talking about the symptoms as well. So other examples is I find too much information or sensory overload can trigger me into some quite serious fatigue. So if we go out for a meal, for example, I like to sit at the end of the table, preferably with the wall behind me, so that all the noise is coming in one direction. And then I can just focus on that and filter out. If I'm sat in the middle of the table, I find that really hard. And so it took us a while to realize that. So now whenever we go out, for example, Jane will always say, right, where do you want to sit that's best for you? And that's an example. And just so many examples where the patience was, and not to shout at me when I couldn't do what I could do before, but to try and sympathize and try and say, well, okay, you can't think quite as quickly, you can't walk so much, you can't drive. Let's work out between us how we're gonna make that work. And that was just it's fantastic. I don't realize, I mean, at the time I probably didn't realize how lucky I was having that support. The kids as well, I mean, the two lads were off at uni, but Ellen was at home. And again, that closeness of support where they hadn't given up, so I wasn't going to give up. I'd always said after the treatment, so it would have been the next sort of January time, I wanted to watch the Super Bowl, because we're big NFL fans, American football fans, in my Packers shirt on the sofa with my kids and Jane. And we kind of did that, and we agreed that was one of the goals we'd set ourselves a year afterwards. I'm going to be there. And it's things like that, you just think, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go the extra sort of half a mile with my recovery. I'm going to try and push myself. I'm going to try and get back to where, not to where I was, because I'm a different person now, but to make the most of what I've got. And that sort of the love you get and that closeness. I consider myself extremely lucky that I had that with me through that journey.
Well, a shout out to Jane there, Andy. She sounds absolutely amazing.
Oh, she is. And why she puts up with this grumpy old man, I've no idea. But yeah. The other thing as well, which might be quite useful for other people going through this, is that it took me a couple of years, I think, probably two and a half years, to realise that I was different. So I couldn't think as quickly. I couldn't drive. Bit of tinnitus, so I had to be careful when I was out and things like that. So there were some symptoms that will never go away, and the fatigue, the extra tiredness as well, is there. And it took me a couple of years to actually realize, rather than to stop beating myself up for not being able to do the things I could do before and accept that I'm different. I've just been through major brain trauma, and you know that this applies, I think, probably to anyone who's been through brain trauma, is to not beat yourself up that you can't get back to where you were, accept that, almost grieve Andy Mark one and kind of celebrate Andy Mark two and go, right, this is who I am. This is what I can do. Let's make the most of that. Now, how can I best use that with my family and with me to sort of get the best out of what life I've got left? And once you come to that sort of almost like revelation, and Jane had a big part in when we talked it through, getting to that point and accept that I'm different. I've just been through major brain trauma. And, you know, that this applies, I think, probably to anyone who's been through brain trauma, is to not beat yourself up that you can't get back to where you were. Accept that, almost grieve Andy Mark one and kind of celebrate Andy Mark two and go, right, this is who I am. This is what I can do. Let's make the most of that. Now, how can I best use that with my family and with me to sort of get the best out of what life I've got left? And once you come to that sort of almost like revelation, and Jane had a big part in when we talked it through, getting to that point, life becomes easier, because you then realize partly I'm here, and also I'm a great believer, and there's two sayings I always talk about, and my kids will attest to this. One is, excuse the language, but shit happens, deal with it. And the other one is, life's not fair, get over it. Life becomes easier, because you then realize partly I'm here, and also I'm a great believer, and there's two sayings I always talk about, and my kids will attest to this. One is, excuse the language, but shit happens, deal with it. And the other one is, life's not fair, get over it. So those are two tenets I kind of live by. And this encapsulated both of them. So stop feeling sorry for yourself, deal with the issues, and try and make the best of what you are now. And that's kind of how I'm living my life at the moment.
I think that's some really great advice, Andy. I think it is that, okay, I can't do what I used to be able to do, but this is what I can do. Let's focus on that. And I think that is absolutely just brilliant advice.
I think so. And it can take a while. I've talked to other people that have had brain tumors. Some say it took them 4 or 5 years to come to that. I was chatting to a lady just last week. She said it took 4 or 5 years in a divorce before she realized that she is now someone that's different, and to sort of celebrate who she is and who you are and what you can do, rather than grieve over what you've lost. But it's like grief. It's different for everyone. So you can't say to someone, you know, right, accept that, give up the old person. You've got to get there in your own time. That's probably one of the biggest pieces of advice I would say to someone that's been through a brain trauma is understand that. The sooner you can get there, the better your quality of life is.
It's a journey and it's a process. And, you know, obviously you had a brain tumor, and our husbands had brain injury. Like, it's all very much related, and all the things that you're talking about, the effects, the impact, are incredibly, the loss of that person are all the same. On the GDA.
Yes, and the people I've talked to, it's brain injury, whatever that brain injury is. It can have the same effect.
And also, I think when you were talking about, you know, the size of your tumor and the kind of early diagnosis being important, because that can result in more brain injury later. Obviously, I know that there are, I think, over 120 different types of brain tumor, and
yes, outcomes there
are different for each. So it's not a simple picture, but certainly, yes, it's very, of course, related to the same symptoms of as people having recovering from stroke or traumatic brain injury.
Yes, definitely.
I really want to ask you about that 2-year period, Andy, when you're talking about it took you that 2 years to kind of fully accept what had happened to you and kind of accept the new you, really.
Yes.
In that 2 years, how were you dealing with that process, and how much insight did you have to it? I mean, I guess I'm thinking, were you angry? Were you frustrated? Were you thinking you were going to get better? What was it in that 2-year period that suddenly shifted when you were able to get to the point of acceptance?
I think for me, partly was when I retired from work. So my operation was in early 2017. I retired in the December of 2019. So that sort of two and a half year period, I felt that I could get back to what I was doing before. So yes, I can get back to work. I can get back to the same job. I can carry on. It's a brain tumor. I've dealt with it. I'm an engineer. I've sorted that problem. Move on. So I was kind of soldiering on. But it was becoming harder because the fatigue was becoming tougher. And so on the weekends, I was literally spending the whole time just trying to recover from the week. So it was all the things you said. It was massive frustration. Why can't I remember what I could do before? It's the same brain. Why can't I walk as far? Why can't I drive? Real frustration, and anger. Yeah. Why has this happened to me? Why me? It's not fair. Life's not fair. I think that what tipped the balance for me was when I retired. At that time, I also started volunteering for the Brain Tumor Charity. And once I'd retired and I'd realized, actually, you're never going to get back to work as you were before and do the job to the capability you could do before. So stop beating yourself up over that. You've retired. There's a silver lining to this because it wasn't part of my life's plan to retire then. So there's a silver lining there. And then through the charity and the volunteering, I realized that I could still have an impact. I could still make something significant of my life. So it wasn't just going to be retire and sit in the corner and drift off. It was, you've got experiences which are fairly unique. You're able to talk. You're able to articulate. You've got some skills from, life and senior management. Why not put all those things together? And volunteering gave me the opportunity to do that. Even though I had reduced sort of memory, I got more tired more easily and those sorts of things, and I couldn't drive, I had some experiences. And there was pride also that I'd proved to myself, my family, and especially my kids that no matter what happens in life, deal with it. Don't give in. Keep your humor, move on. So there was pride as well that I'd got to that point. And I think once, looking back, I hadn't really thought about it now, as you mentioned, the volunteering, I think, really helped because it showed me that I could do things that were fairly, use my unique set of circumstances to benefit others. And that, I think, made me realize, actually, I've loved life since I retired. This is what, 3 years ago. I've loved life. It's been great because
We know how valuable volunteering is to so many people, Andy, on that pathway of acceptance and recovery. And you speak about that really powerfully, how obviously your role as a volunteer has been very fulfilling to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think everyone needs something in their life to give them significance, be that their work, be that their charity podcast like you guys. It's something that gives you a feeling of you're doing something positive. I mean, I'm quite a positive person despite what's happened. It's just how I am.
I think it gives you purpose.
Yes.
Like you're saying, a fulfillment, a purpose, and going beyond yourself, being able to help other people.
It absolutely. And what the other powerful thing for me is that you're choosing to do it. So kind of when you're at work, you kind of have to do stuff. You have to do what you need to do to earn the money to keep the family in the manner to which they're accustomed. But with volunteering, it's a completely different mindset. You're choosing to do something. And when you choose to do something, it feels much more beneficial to me anyway, to your well-being, because you're choosing to do something to help others as well. So you don't get paid for it, but the thanks you get and the gratitude. I've had so many thank yous and gratitude for my 2.5-3 years of volunteering, heartfelt as well, that I got in 30 years in industry, to be honest. I would thoroughly recommend volunteering to anyone if you can afford the time and you can afford to do it, because that feeling of purpose, like you say, is palpable, and it's massively helped me and my and the family, because they get involved as well. It's helped us, I think, in our recovery.
And it's also led you to the Houses of Parliament, Andy, hasn't it?
Well, it's not for me to name drop. But now you mention it. I mean, among other things, so I've I do quite a few things. Mainly, it was mainly with the Brain Tumor Charity, because they were the charity that really helped me out at my darkest hour. Because I went on, and they have some closed Facebook groups that allow you to go in and talk to others. And that's the first time I had hope, because I saw there were other people with similar brain tumors to myself that were still alive 5, 10, 15 years. I thought, ah, there's hope. So I wanted to give something back. So I've most of my volunteers with the Brain Tumor Charity, and they've allowed me to get involved into all sorts of things. And last year, I was voted the Volunteer of the Year for the charity, which, like, oh, biggest brain tumor charity in the world, and I'm Volunteer of the Year. That's nice.
Congratulations.
Huge congratulations, Andy. That's just wonderful.
I also got, this is another one that surprised me. I don't know if you've heard about the Third Sector Charity Awards. So these are like the Oscars for the charity sector. And I was shortlisted for Volunteer of the Year. I didn't win it, but I got a special commendation. So that almost meant more to me, because that was across the whole of the charities, all the volunteers. And there must be hundreds and hundreds of thousands. And that was outside the brain tumor sort of community as well. And they were thinking, this guy's made a difference enough to give him a special commendation.
That's amazing, Andy. Well done. Oh, we're going to see your award. Look at that. So yes, Third Sector. Wonderful.
So, and I should hasten to add before people switch off, no one volunteers for awards. You volunteer for the purpose it gives you and the benefit you can bring to others. But when you get an award, it's kind of, it's almost validation that you're making an impact and making a difference. So that was great. So the Houses of Parliament. So I also volunteer for another charity called Radiotherapy UK, funnily enough, because I've had radiotherapy. And they were launching their 10-year strategy just last month in the Houses of Parliament. So they asked, no, this month, actually, gosh. So they asked me if I would go up and speak at that launch. So that was an interesting experience, into the Houses of Parliament, into Westminster, into one of the rooms, and talking in front of a room full of consultants, MPs, charity leaders, and just talking. What they wanted to hear was the patient voice. So they're trying to launch a 10-year strategy for radiotherapy across all cancers across the whole of the UK. And they wanted someone who's had radiotherapy just to talk about it, because it gives more credibility, I think, this is what they said, to the message you're getting across. But it's not big words, it's not flowery. It is actually someone who's been through it talking about it. So yes, I had I don't know if I call it a pleasure, because I had to put a suit on, and I hate wearing suits. So it was talking to the MPs and people in the Houses of Parliament at the launch of the strategy. So that would never have happened if I hadn't got into volunteering. So I'm also, if I can mention it as well, I think you mentioned at the start that I'm the co-chair of the Brain Tumor Charity podcast. Let's talk about brain tumors. So that I've been doing for about 2 years now. So that's allowed me to meet some amazing people like yourselves and hear some real inspirational, difficult, emotional stories as well about how people have coped with what they're dealing with. But also one of the first times with my kids, I was cool, because that podcast is issued on Spotify. So they couldn't believe it, that their dad was going to be a co-author of a podcast on Spotify. So for once in my life, I was cool. And I'd have never had that without what had happened. So that was another silver lining to the volunteering.
Yeah, and On a Good Day is also on Spotify, Andy. So
it is.
Guess
I had
that
the pleasure.
Makes us cool too.
Well, you're on Spotify. Absolutely, you are cool. It's like, it's the biggest streaming platform in the world, and you're there. So yeah.
Yeah. And on Amazon. So we love that we can find it on Amazon as well. So on the big
there you go. You are cool, you see. So don't worry, the youngsters appreciate what you're doing.
And Apple, just to mention that.
Apple
and
is
any
biggie.
Podcast
Apple's
provider.
Biggie.
Yes.
We love all of the podcast platforms, can I just?
Yes, they're all equally
wherever you get them. But before we let you go, Andy, you've touched upon fatigue, and possibly you're feeling it a little bit now. What are ways that you deal with your fatigue? Because it's so common after any brain trauma.
Yes, yeah. So the way I deal with mine is, and it took me a while to realise this, Not that I'm a nerd, but I use a spreadsheet. What I do, and I still do it now, I've done it since my operation, actually, so it's quite big now. So
that's cool, Andy. Spreadsheets are cool.
There we go. So I did have so what I basically do is, and I was doing it while I was at work, is I color code sort of activities that I do during a day broadly, and then I'll color code how I feel that evening. So what that, and when you look at that, so it's mainly green, but I'll color code it. So if it's something that takes a real, you know, like talking to the house of parliament, that's a red. If it's something like this in a nice way, which is also, you have to concentrate hard for this in orange. So you know, and what I was noticing was if I had a lot of reds and oranges clustered together, after about a day or two, I would, the evenings, I'd feel really fatigued. And it was, for me, it was noticeable the pattern of what caused or exacerbated my fatigue. For me, fatigue, I liken it to having a you know, everyone's brains is like a phone battery. You know, you go to sleep, you wake up, your battery's probably fairly 80-90% charged, and it drains during the day, but it never gets to 20%. With people that have had a brain injury, because quite often your sleep's disrupted and you don't sleep so well, you wake up and it's about 60%. And because your brain's fighting whatever's going on as well, it drains more quickly. So it can quite quickly get down below 20% when you're in the red. And that for me is when fatigue happens. Mm-hmm. So I almost plan, what I do now is I try and plan what I'm doing almost each day, but certainly each week. If I'm doing something that needs a lot of concentration or that drains my mental energy, then I'll try and space it out. So for example, like tomorrow, I've got absolutely nothing planned at all. So I'm lucky that I can do that because I'm retired. But so, and the other thing is, well, I don't call them like day, I call them recovery days. So again, I don't beat myself up for the fact that tomorrow I'll do diddly squat. But that for me is allowing my brain to recover so that it can do the next, whatever I need it to do, sort of back end of the week. I can only stop the fatigue by sleep. And for me, it has to be an overnight sleep. That's how I get rid of fatigue. So if it comes on during the day, it's an absolute nightmare because it's a one-way journey. And you start feeling, I liken it to, if people haven't had fatigue, it's like having a hangover, really bad hangover, but you haven't had the fun of getting drunk. So it's a one-way street. So for me, eating regularly helps. So if I miss a meal, within about half an hour to 4 to 5 minutes of when I normally eat, I can start feeling quite headachy. Because I thought I might have diabetes. I don't. It's just because the brain's taking so much energy. If I don't eat at certain times during the day, so, for example, and this is where Jane's very good. If we're going on a car journey or somewhere we're not sure where we're going to be for lunchtime, don't shoot me, but I'll take a tin of beans so I can eat them in the car. Yes, they're cold. So,
like baked beans?
Yeah, Heinz baked beans. I know. So, but I know.
Well, I think that's one of the best tips we've had on the podcast so far. Take a tin of baked beans. Now they've got the ring pull. You don't need the can opener, but you need
exactly.
a spoon.
My husband would love that strategy.
So it is. So when, yeah, so if we're going on a car journey or somewhere where I can't guarantee that I'm, because I normally have lunch at 12 o'clock, basically. And genuinely, if I get to half 12 and I'm not eating, I'll know. I won't have to look at the clock. My brain will start saying, mate, you need to eat. Yeah, so I'll take a tin of beans and I've got to quite like them. So I'll know now that if it's going to be delayed or late, I can have that tin of beans and it won't cause me fatigue, because once the fatigue starts, it carries on. So that's a good tip.
Tip, thank you.
Doesn't have to be baked beans. What would you call them? Other
snacks.
Sort of healthy snacks,
isn't it?
Healthy snacks are available. Yeah,
but that's some great advice, Andy. Going back, I actually really like the way, and it is a little bit geeky, and I wouldn't necessarily have a spreadsheet, but I like the fact the red, the orange, the green, and you know, I could. You know, we all, to some extent, get a bit of fatigue. But
yes,
having
yeah.
that in your mind, obviously, particularly when you've had a brain trauma, having that in your mind and spacing it out, I think is a great idea.
There is also another very useful model, and I don't know if you've heard about the spoon theory, that actually energy measured in spoons and different activities take different amounts of energy, amounts of spoons, but also you can have less spoons. So if, for example, at the beginning of the day you've had a really interrupted and poor night's sleep, you're also starting with less spoons than someone else might be. So if you then take that and the activity that you're doing takes a lot of them, it kind of explains that that sum. It's called the spoon theory. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's my take on it, because I have heard about that, and I tried to explain that to my kids, and you get like the look. What are you talking about, Dad? So that's why I liken it to phone batteries. Yeah. So for me, if you've had, like you said, it sadly often happens, if you've had a bad night's sleep and it's been interrupted, I'll wake up and my phone will only be 60% charged, if that makes sense. Whereas if I've had a good night's sleep, it'll be 80% charged. And that difference could make the difference between going into the red of 20% when you should, you know, when your phone tells you it needs to recharge. So it's exactly the same thing, but I liken it to a phone battery, mainly because I could explain it more relevantly to my kids.
To the youngsters.
Anyway, that's
the cool, hip way of explaining it. Yeah.
It helps, because everyone's got a mobile phone and everyone has the difficulty of recharging it. So by saying that, people can go, oh, I kind of get that now. Yeah, I get that.
Andy, it's been amazing to talk to you today. It really has. And
I think
you've left us with so many strategies and things to think about. And also that message for people, if they do have persistent symptoms, to actually take them seriously and get them checked out. And you mentioned about headaches. Obviously, we know with high blood pressure, that can be undiagnosed, you know, cause of headaches as well, which is really, really important to get checked out. But I think that that's been a really clear message about, you know, taking those things seriously if they're continuing. And I think the other takeaway is baked beans in the car with a spoon, but lots and lots of other things too. So thank you so much, and I can absolutely see why you were nominated for a Volunteer of the Year award across the whole of the third sector. So it really has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Thank you, Andy. And I think you've talked about hope a lot, and I think you've given hope to a lot of people out there who can see you can have an incredibly fulfilled life after a brain tumour, after brain injury. And that is a real beacon of light. So thank you so much for sharing your light with us today for On a Good Day. If you enjoyed listening to Andy, check out the episode we did with him and Sarah from the Brain Tumour Charity for their podcast, Let's Talk About Brain Tumours. Scroll just a little way up to episode 26, Life After Brain Injury, and you can hear more about our story there as well. If you're interested in volunteering, we did a whole episode on that with our partners, Hector and Paul. That's number 16. Lots of others too. Catch up with them when you can. Thank you for listening. And as ever, have a very good day. We'll see you next time.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.